You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. And Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your hosts Don Olson and Dave Kudnick here to talk to you about what's our take on what's going on in the world. Well, we're going to get to a Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate from the Gray Zone. And Max Blumenthal gave a few weeks back, we played a beginning of his history of U.S. Involvement in illegal bad activities against us, Latin America. And he was talking about in the context of what's developing in Venezuela. And today we're going to go into that a bit more, including someone who is one of the inside architects of this whole Venezuelan adventure.
Yeah, thanks, Don. I want to add before we hear the tape that the blatant illegal and murderous activity around Venezuela is the latest example where the U.S. claims to be a force for democracy and rule of law are shown to be a pretense, an official lie that most of the world sees through. Look at also Gaza. Well, we can't claim to be a force for rule of law there, and contrary to the last speaker under Democracy Now!, former assistant to Bernie Sanders, we can't claim any legal or moral standing in Ukraine either. So keep in mind, this is the context, not some exceptional thing happening in Venezuela right now.
Yes, that was the commentator in Democracy Now! Who was commenting about things international. Well, this is, let's play this. This was posted on Monday, and
after the tape, we'll talk about
the Venezuela campaign seems to be stalled right now. I don't know if Trump has decided what to do. Marco Rubio, his entire career rests on this. And if Trump doesn't authorize a regime change war, Rubio looks terrible. And if he does, I think Venezuela becomes a Libya in the Western Hemisphere. And there's now enormous amounts of pressure to try to tip the scales. And you have figures who were in the first Trump administration, like Marshall Billingsley, who was in the, I think, State Department, Treasury Department. His job was mainly to help devise sanctions and financially destroy Venezuela to fuel the waves of migrants to the U.S. This is what Marshall Billingsley's up to. I mean, this guy is a real warmonger who was also in the George W. Bush administration, is one of the neocons who infested the foreign policy bureaucracy of Trump. And what's he doing here? I mean, he's just tweeting images of buildings. Well, this is the Simon Bolivar Clinic of Caracas. It's a hospital. I think you can understand what he's doing here. The rumor is that Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Cecilia Flores are occupying an entire floor of this clinic, and Marshall Billingsley is calling in U.S. Tomahawk airstrikes to kill them and bomb a hospital Israeli style. I mean, this is the sickness of the advocates of this psychotic regime change war against a country that poses no threat to the United States.
I know of Billingsley because he was in charge of arms control under the first Trump administration.
Right.
And he basically helped kill the INF treaty, which Trump withdrew from, and also helped ignore the expiration of the New START treaty, which is the last remaining treaty limiting the stockpiles of U.S. and Russia, which Biden actually saved after he came into office at the very last minute. So no surprise that he's, you know, continuing his, like, hegemonic commitments in Latin America, where, you know, Venezuela now is the number one target.
Then Billingsley actually let the cat out of the bag, testifying. He's at the Hudson Institute, a neocon think tank in D.C., and he testified before Congress in October. His testimony focused on Venezuela being this major drug export capital, but also that Hezbollah was based in Venezuela. This is one of the major talking points of the neocons, because they want to convince Americans that somehow Venezuela threatens them, although we've never been attacked by Hezbollah. I think we were attacked by another according to official reports, the U.S. was attacked by another organization, which now controls Syria, but that's a subject for another day.
That has fostered the socialist plague that has spread across Latin America. It's the Venezuelans. It's corrupt, dirty Venezuelan money that underwrote the Petro campaign. They funneled money into Mexico. They funneled money into Brazil. Once we have democracy restored in Venezuela, all of that subversion money that has been underwriting the socialist campaigns around the region dries up. So does the oil revenues to the Cuban regime, all of the support to the Nicaraguans. We forget about what Ortega is doing to the Nicaraguans.
So essentially, this isn't about terrorism, narco-terrorism. This isn't about drugs. It's about destroying the Latin American left. And not just in Cuba and Nicaragua, but in Brazil and Mexico, where Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum is facing right-wing protests dressed up as a Gen Z revolution, which are just astroturfed, oligarch-funded protests, where they're chanting against her being Jewish, but the ADL doesn't care because she's supportive of Palestine. You get the point. This is about geopolitics. It's about neocon control. It's about taking the PNAC clean break document program for the Middle East and applying it to the Western Hemisphere. And it starts with Venezuela, because Venezuela has been an economic engine through ALBA in sustaining other left-wing and progressive governments in Latin America. And that's what Marshall Billingsley's in it for. That's what Elliot Abrams has surfaced this week to call for regime change. And you know who's against it, against this program? It's not just almost the entire voting public of the United States. There's almost no one outside of South Florida who supports this, outside of the Gusano Industrial Complex. It's also the top JAG lawyer at U.S. Southern Command, the top military lawyer at U.S. Southern Command, has said that boat strikes are illegal.
Camping World is America's used RV supercenter.
Six sources told NBC News that the top JAG lawyer weighed in on the boat strikes and said, and other military lawyers are saying that they're illegal, have expressed concerns to senior officials in their commands and at the Defense Department about the legality of the strikes. These strikes, by the way, have killed close to 80 people. We don't really know who they are. They're on small boats that cannot possibly reach the United States. Some of the boats have 11 to 13 people. You would think that you would not want to take that many people if you want to maximize the drug supply. No due process. The JAG at Southern Command specifically expressed concern that strikes against people on boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific, whom administration officials call narco-terrorists, could amount to extrajudicial killings and therefore legally expose service members involved in the operations, legally expose them to war crimes charges. That's pretty significant. And the head of Southern Command, the top general in charge, his name is Alvin Halsley, is on his way out. He's leaving because he objects to Pete Hegseth's policy. So the top general and the top lawyer at Southern Command, which is in charge of carrying out orders for Trump Rubio on Venezuela, opposed the policy. I don't know if we've ever seen anything in recent times like this.
No, and this is after they also forced out the chair of the Joint Chiefs, C. Hugh Brown, who I've been told was also not a big fan of Trump's regime change plans, both in Latin America and also in Iran as well. So, but yet, look, let's talk about Gregory Meeks.
Here's the opposition.
Yeah. So Democrats recently had this like sort of like half-hearted effort to have a measure in Congress to, you know, curtail Trump's regime change war in Venezuela. It failed. And Gregory Meeks, who helped lead that effort, he went and had a friendly chat with the U.S. government-funded Venezuelan opposition figure and recent Nobel Peace Prize winner who Trump wants to install after overthrowing Maduro.
Yeah, this is, well, there it is. It looks like...
Just scroll down a little bit. Scroll down so we can see them both. There we go.
Here's the photo that Gregory Meeks tweeted of him and war-crazed fanatic Maria Corina Machado, who personally called on Benjamin Netanyahu to stage an Israeli military invasion of Venezuela. And Gregory Meeks was supposed to be the leader of the war powers resolution to stop this war. Why would you do this? Like, why do you feel compelled to tweet this image showing that, you know, it looks like just like a their best friends? What were they even talking about? We don't know. But it helps explain why the War Powers Resolution was so poorly crafted. And it was sponsored by other Democratic war hawks like Jason Crow. Remember, Jason Crow joined with Liz Cheney to sponsor the resolution attempting to prevent any withdrawal from Afghanistan, permanent U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. These are the Democrats on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House.
It's so embarrassing. It's just so embarrassing. But it's pure Democrat. It's so classic. Oppose Trump's regime change war in Venezuela while propping up the figurehead he wants to install after regime change in Venezuela. Democrats.
Yeah. Oppose it just enough for it not to work.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same way they engineered the end of the government shutdown, where they take a few Democrats who are resigning and a few others who aren't up for re-election until like 2030, so no one will remember that they did this, and have them vote to end the shutdown, and then the leadership complains and said, Chuck Schumer's like, "Well, I was against it. I personally opposed it. I just didn't whip them or threaten them in any way."
You know what also reminds me of? It reminds me of the people who attack us and smear us for exposing regime change propaganda and who themselves parrot regime change propaganda while still claiming that they oppose regime change. So they prop up the talking points of the regime change campaign that they claim to oppose. And that's what
they run the ball to the 1 yard line.
Yeah.
And then they're like, no, you've got to kick a field goal. You can't ram it in. It's what they did on Syria. The Democrats, every think tank, most of the institutional left supported crippling Venezuela financially, attacked the Bolivarian Revolution in one way or another. They all did. They all got in on it in one way or another. Jacobin used to run these articles by this demented Trotskyist whose name was like Mike Gonzalez, just week after week attacking Venezuela. They ran an article attacking Telesur and Jacobin that show they're the good, you know, social Democrats, or they're democratic socialists. They're not, you know, the bad Marxist-Leninists. And now, I mean, they're publishing great stuff opposing this war, and I think it's been educational for a lot of them on the left, but the Democrats haven't learned anything.
I personally find it hard to imagine.
Well, that was the Gray Zone people, Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate.
I'd like to offer a few comments supplementing what Max said about why this attack on Venezuela is happening. First of all, remember that as far back as Obama, He evoked the national security threat, the all-purpose excuse for war and subversion and the coups and the like. So it's been quite a while that the U.S. has been attacking Venezuela. So why? The latest thing we're hearing is drugs, but it's fairly easily disproved, and almost everyone across the spectrum is saying this isn't really what's going on, because Venezuela is not a known source of fentanyl at all, and very little of cocaine. In fact, if you look at the Drug Enforcement Agency's charts online, for sources of these drugs, Venezuela is way, way down. You know, it's not even in the top 12. And so it's false. And so that's not it. Is it oil? Well, that's often said sort of as a reflexive judgment, because after all, wars are fought over resources in great part. But there's a complicated relationship with Venezuela's colonial history, as a result of which the refining for their heavy oil is in Texas, Louisiana, Gulf area, and U.S. actually needs that heavy oil either from Canadian tar sands or Venezuela to blend with their fracking oil, because the fracking oil is not heavy enough to produce diesel, the all-important, most important petrol fuel of all, nor jet fuel and kerosene. Okay, so there's a complicated relationship there, and it's probably true that we have our eyes on control of the oil facilities, which are mostly offshore, and would and do to some degree supplement. You know, Venezuela had Conoco gas here for many, many years, and then we seized their property in our usual rule of law fashion. Okay, so it's not necessarily about oil, although it's clearly a key factor, Venezuela having the world's largest reserves of oil that, again, complements ours. Is it the ideological example that Max talked a lot about? I believe this is definitely a major factor. In other words, just like Cuba, just like Nicaragua, we don't want to tolerate any examples in the hemisphere of wealth sharing on the part of national policy and national government. You can call it socialist, you call it what you want. But the example we do not want is restrictions on private profit and distribution of some significant portion of national wealth through control of resources to the people at large. That's what the Bolivarian Revolution was about. That's what the Cuban Revolution was about. That's what the Sandinista Revolution was about. So I think this is a big, big part of it. In other words, same as our larger global strategy since the Cold War ended. We're in 1992. The Defense Department papers available online. It explains how we were not going to tolerate any peer power, so we regarded ourselves from that point on as the global superpower, and any ideological contrast is not going to be allowed. Finally, an important factor is Rubio, who has a hatred of Cuba from when his parents left there, and also is strongly opposed to Nicaragua, opposed to the Bolivarian Revolution. But again, example of why it's not about drugs. He's good friends with Noboas, the Ecuadorian president, who's been guilty of deep drug trade through his family company, Bonita Bananas. That's where you get lots of cocaine coming in the U.S. and in Europe as well. And Rubio's brother-in-law was convicted of major, major cocaine dealing, and it came out in that he had stored large quantities in Rubio's house for a while. So that's why I say his name should be Marco Narco Rubio.
Marco Narco, yes. Yes, and if you're of a certain age, you might even remember when Venezuela had Citgo as their own brand of gas stations in this country.
Yeah, I meant to say Citgo, right? We seized it just like we seized other enemy state assets illegally.
Yeah, there used to be a few around that would try to support them. Well, let's go on to talk about John Mearsheimer. He's this well-regarded realist school of
historian, University of Chicago. One thing John wouldn't say, because he doesn't offer much humor, but he does have a sense of humor, but it's been said by others that Venezuela is Spanish for Vietnam.
And he's going to be talking on to the point of the unreal threat of Venezuela to the U.S. or us. Or
for two reasons. One is just it doesn't make much sense from a purely military point of view. You'd need a lot of troops. This is not Grenada or Panama. Venezuela is a huge piece of real estate, and they have substantial military forces. And if you're going to invade that country for purposes of doing regime change, you'd need a really large force. And then once you're in there, you're in there, and getting out is always very difficult. So we'd end up having many tens of thousands, maybe even 100+ thousand troops in Venezuela. And then the question you have to ask yourself is, if we did that, could we fix the problem? In other words, could we put in some sort of democratically elected leader and we'd all live happily ever after in Venezuela? That's not going to happen, right? So the idea of putting troops on the ground makes no sense at all. And I think that, you know, you can talk about maybe sending in special forces teams that can decapitate the regime, or using air power or naval power to coerce Venezuela. But when you look carefully at these options, they don't spell success either. First of all, Maduro is going to be very hard to get at. He knows you're coming after him, and he's going to do everything he can to hide. But even if you get him, where does that lead? How do you right the situation in Venezuela? I mean, if you think about it, and this is always how I think about these sorts of operations, and it goes back to the fact that I was in the American military during the Vietnam War from 1965 to 1975. And one thing I learned then is that when you go into countries like Vietnam or Venezuela, you're engaging in social engineering. And social engineering is incredibly difficult to do. And militaries are not good at social engineering. Militaries are good at breaking things, killing people. They're giant killing machines. And they're filled with people who are not exactly suited to engage in social engineering, especially in places like Venezuela, where the politics are incredibly complicated. So I don't see how military force of any sort can solve this problem in any reasonable time frame, or maybe forever. And I have the sense that President Trump understands that. I think Trump likes to talk tough, and he'll use military force, but actually in a very selective way. If you think about the war against the Houthis, right? He was very angry with what the Houthis were doing in the Red Sea. He said that the Biden administration was filled with pussycats, and those pussycats couldn't defeat the Houthis. But I, Donald Trump, will turn the American military loose, and we'll take care of the Houthis. Well, after about 1 month, and I mean 1 month, right, he said, we quit. These Houthis are really tough hombres, and we can't beat them. And that was the end of it. And then there's the Iran 12-day war. We attacked Iran on only 1 day. We flew these sophisticated bombers over a handful of targets, dropped big bombs on those targets, and it lasted 1 day. It was June 22nd of this year. But we have done nothing since. So he can't really say that he started a war against Iran or he started a war against the Houthis. He just, you know, launched one attack on Iran, and he fought with the Houthis for 1 month and then walked away and basically accepted the fact that the Houthis won. So given that, the question is, what do you think he's going to do in Venezuela? Do you think he's going to launch ground forces into Venezuela? Especially since the MAGA base is adamantly opposed to this. I think that's hard to imagine. And then you get down to the question of whether he'd try to use air power or naval power. And as you say, I argue in my book that, you know, land power is usually the way you have to go when you go to war against a country. And I think that's true here. I think, you know, we got rid of Saddam Hussein. How did we do it? We had to invade Iraq. And then we had to search around the country, find the guy, and kill him, and then do social engineering. Do you want to do that in Venezuela? I don't think so. And I don't think Trump wants to do it. It's not what his base wants to do. So all this is a long way of saying, I find it hard to believe that he's going to do anything substantial from a military point of view against Venezuela. I wouldn't be surprised if he tried to work out a deal with Maduro. Because just, you know, a pinprick type attack is not going to buy him very much. And people will point that out to him. And therefore, it just makes more sense to back off, cut a deal. But that causes all sorts of problems because he's talked like Mr. Tough Guy. And here's Mr. Tough Guy now cutting a deal with somebody who's supposed to be a narco-terrorist and one of the greatest threats to stability we've ever seen in the Western Hemisphere and so forth and so on. So you're going to cut a deal with him? But anyway, that's, I think, where we are.
When your kid is hurt,
so that was John Mearsheimer, and he was at his Substack. John Mearsheimer at Substack.com, and he was pictured with Rachel Bloom's from Financial Wise, but it's a. Even what they're saying, stopping the drugs, there was an article this last week in Star Tribune about the way this naval armada, the way they're situated, they're not even near whatever the considered drug route lanes are in the Caribbean. I mean, there are some that come out from Colombia, and some from
Ecuador,
but and so they're not situated on there. But be that as it may, it's an unreal, and the way things proceed in official Washington, where you try and scare the bejabbers out of people. You blame them for this huge drug problem. It's gone on, the opioids, and that people taking fentanyl, and as Dave talked about, the fentanyl mostly comes through Mexico.
Also Canada.
And Canada.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
And so it's, Why is that? Some of it because people are oftentimes in jobs where their body hurts and they're not really being taken care of well enough by the health system here. But be that as it may, you can get hooked on it pretty easily. So, but Venezuela, it seems to be a way to rev up, but
it's just the latest in a whole global series of conflicts where we're trying to maintain supremacy. So that's a larger context as I see it. I want to say one more thing about the drug war because I didn't recommend this in time to get Don to view it, but there was a really great 30-minute commentary by Santa Cruz, Arizona County Sheriff David Hathaway, was on Judging Freedom, which is Judge Napolitano's program, 2 weeks ago. That is around November 20th. And I can't recommend it highly enough. This is a person with on-the-ground experience And he kind of got a homegrown radical perspective and understanding of the politics of the drug war. And context, I want to just go into it a little bit here, because don't usually hear this stuff, but historically, we have used drugs of various sort, including alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, what have you, to target nationalities, Irish, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Mexican, or ethnic groups to further our larger strategic and hostile aims. In other words, we target groups and make them the scapegoat for whatever drug or other problem we have. And this has actually been going on for decades, as I said, with regard to Mexicans, even earlier, some of the European Italians and Puerto Ricans. Now it's, you know, further to the south. And so we exploit national, racial, and ethnic divisions to further our larger agenda of dominance. So I can recommend highly enough this commentary by Santa Cruz County Sheriff David Hathaway on Judge Napolitano's show approximately November 20th. Highly recommend those who want to look it up and just get the wisdom and hard-won knowledge of a county sheriff about the real meaning and purpose of the drug war, including, as we've been mentioning, where these drugs actually come from. And it's not Venezuela.
No, it's so often it's, well, over the years, it has, from Vietnam, that all this heroin that was coming in from the Golden Triangle up in the northern part of Thailand and the like, but these were being brought in through CIA, auspices, and they were brought in to achieve certain domestic aims at that time. For one thing, as the ghettos were exploding in terms of reacting to hundreds of years of ill treatment.
A groundbreaking book on the modern version of this in Southeast Asia that Don was mentioning was by Alfred McCoy. His very first book was The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, which barely got published. It was against CIA wishes. And now he's, after 50 years, professor emeritus at University of Wisconsin-Madison, still writing great stuff. So there's plenty of documentation on this, and a lot of it did start in Southeast Asia. Then in Afghanistan, we actively took part in the drug trade, which is one of the ways that the CIA makes money. And this, again, is touched upon in Sheriff David Hathaway's commentary.
What do you mean, makes money?
Well, just to offer you another little historical note on this stuff, some of you, many of you are going to remember the Iran-Contra scandal, where new president and his cronies got the release of hostages delayed in Iran and traded that for drugs and money for their Contra friends. But there was also drug trade involved in all of that, which was less visible, less reported. And just interestingly, a couple of days ago, this man centrally involved in all of that, Hassenfruss, was on the plane that was flying from Arkansas, state of Governor Clinton at that point, and they were flying arms and other things, money, to the Contras around 1986. He just died, and it was quite a cast of criminals that he was part of. People, names you might remember, such as Robert McFarlane, John Poindexter, Oliver North, and George Bush Sr., of course, the former CIA director, and Ronald Reagan. And I want to make mention of Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams has reappeared from the shadows with a big article in Foreign Affairs advocating major bombing and invasion of Venezuela. So he's still at it. This is the guy after the Iran-Contra hearings testimony. One congressman said, "He made me want to puke."
He was in various administrations, and he was so reactionary in bringing about U.S. policy and to just damaging all these countries in Central America, mostly Elliot Abrams. And so, as Max Blumenthal just said in our first little selection there, that Elliot Abrams has re-emerged. And I hadn't known about the foreign policy article, but these people are out there, and they're going to do their worst, and we try and bring it up and talk about it and remember it.
Yeah, even the current extrajudicial murder in the waters off Venezuela is making a number of them nervous. That's why you're getting back and forth stories or explanations about it, because it makes them look a little too bad.
Yes, you know, you got to have a certain amount of purity of goals and what you're doing in order to carry it off with enough public opinion.
You might not hear rule of law quite so often anymore for a while.
That'd be worth it. And I know there were some people on the internet who were on Tuesday, they were saying, it's already starting. It's going to start a war in Venezuela. It's coming. It's coming. Well, I wasn't quite sure about that, but...
Another piece on that, Don, sorry to interrupt, has to do with Rubio, because in Moscow as well, as with regards to Venezuela, there's some indications that Rubio is being put back in second place, that he's not leading this charge. He's, you know, one of the more adamant warmongers, and he and Kellogg were sort of demoted on the Moscow conversations, and that appears to be still the case, and I believe, despite his hostility to Venezuela and Cuba, that his viewpoint, I don't believe it's going to prevail for all the reasons that Max Blumenthal as well as Mearsheimer articulated.
Yes.
And the bombing actually doesn't usually work. Plus, again, Venezuela is Spanish for Vietnam. What are the prospects other than, you know, some quick raid and coup, which isn't, it's not going to happen. It's not going to work. There's tremendous popular support despite the problems down there. And, you know, I think, I don't know if you call them wiser heads, but cooler heads might prevail instead of entering into another disaster.
Well, I was thinking this morning, there's probably just enough flotsam and jetsam and kind of unknown quantities about the way this bombing of these boats, the supposedly drug boats coming from Venezuela, that there's just enough things being thrown up in the air that nothing can be pushed very far. Because it wouldn't look good. It wouldn't look good. And it's, you know, another thing, and maybe you've never heard about it, is these boats that are being blown up, these are not craft that could make the whole trip from Venezuela, say, to the U.S. They're not that kind of a boat. You got to have a certain amount of rugged capabilities. Because things can change, and it's a bit of a hike to go that whole way. But we don't need to have any proof, do we, dear citizens of this country? We just accept whatever they say.
They're beyond shame, they're beyond embarrassment, and there's not a lot of pushback within this country. There's plenty of pushback around the world, but pretty pathetically weak, I would say, especially if you start to look at Congress, if you can stay on that.
Yeah, I mean, they finally got a little gumption to speak up about the original blowing up the votes, but when it came out that, somebody may have been killed while they were just hanging on to a mostly destroyed boat, well, then that's more clear-cut, it seems. But there's no justification for what the U.S. is doing. And the very fact that they just keep doing it and think they can just get away with it. I mean, there's a few people have been saying, the whole thing is totally illegal. Somebody from the American Civil Liberties Union certainly has said that, but it hasn't gained enough traction, enough people.
Yeah, the fact that something illegal, as I was indicating at the beginning, is hardly a restraint on the administration's behavior, or past administrations, too. Let's just not make it all Trump, Trump, Trump. I mean, as far back as Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, Obama, they've all been declaring these national security threats. I think it was like four times against Nicaragua in the 20th century that little country was a national security threat against the United States. You know, and it's really about, again, threatening the wealth, the stakes of U.S. corporations, the stakes of the U.S. military, and other things that might be threatened or weakened by a government and ideology that's trying to share the wealth more instead of having be appropriated by other countries and other companies.
Well,
hey, one more thing about the drug war before you go on, Don, if you don't mind. You know, there's definitely a lot of problems with drugs in this country, which is where the demand is coming from. But, you know, if we really wanted to do something about it, we'd have to attack some of the banks that are laundering this money. Mexican cartels launder it mostly in, almost entirely in cash, $400 million per week. It's got to go to a bank. It's got to have one or two names on the account for the bank to approve, and it's probably going to be the head of some cartel. And if we really wanted to, U.S. banks are 100% complicit in this, and we could come down on them. But we know who runs this country.
That's right. That's right. Well, it was sad this week to pick up the last issue of Southside Pride. Eddie Flynn had a little adieu, kind friends, adieu. We can no longer stay with you. We must hang our harps on a weeping willow tree, and may the world go well with thee.
Probably not original to Eddie.
No, but he used it. And it's so he says at 87, he says he's getting too old. And I heard behind the scenes that he tried to get somebody to take it over. But whatever, just to that, he hadn't been able. So I always counted on him to have his commentary on the state of city politics, especially in Minneapolis and all that, city council, where he once served for, I think, one term, and back in the 70s, and then the mayor's races and all that. So he's always had things to say, and he lists off what he was not able to accomplish, even though he had many columns on it, namely the killing, the police, Minneapolis Police Department killing of Terrence Franklin. And that was kind of a horrible thing in a basement where there was, they said that he was, Terrence Franklin was trying to go for the gun of somebody, but none of the facts fit whatever what the police were saying. And Eddie also tried to do something about Lake Hiawatha and the way it's set up, and he has a history of it. You should pick up a copy of this December 2025 issue of Southside Pride. And David has your last column in there, too.
One final effort. Thank you, Eddie. And talking about some of the historical background one more time, because people think the war started in 2022, and that's just not the case. You got to understand a little bit more than that. And then I also talk about propaganda, because we are steeped in it so much so that it's like the water surrounding the fish. The fish doesn't even know what water is. And so I just try to point out some of the, briefly, some of the techniques of propaganda that we're subject to.
And, you know, and we do talk about this often. People might say, well, why would you keep talking about it? Well, the Star Tribune has articles on it most every day, but here I read some from last week. Now let's take from today, the Associated Press. Ukraine, European allies accuse Russia of feigning interest in peace. And here's a quote from the United Kingdom Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, and saying that the Russian leader, Putin, should end the bluster and the bloodshed and be ready to come to the table to support a just and lasting peace. Now, I know the British Foreign Ministry has good records, and they would quite readily know that Boris Johnson in 2022, a month after the Russians went into Ukraine, after many years of being provoked, and there had been an Istanbul meeting, a peace gathering between the Ukraine and Russia, and others were there, President of Israel, and it was all initialed that Russia would withdraw and have the original borders of the Ukraine, and then Russian language would be not being attacked, and the Russian-Ukrainian religion would be available. And as initialed there in March of 2022, the war began in February 2022, and Boris Johnson, then Prime Minister of Great Britain, flew to Kiev and told Zelensky, don't sign it, don't go forward, we'll support you. Well, that and all the support of the U.S. and NATO has kept this war going. It could have been over there, but nobody talks about it.
And the previous speaker on Democracy Now! Was repeating these falsehoods that you heard every day again, more propaganda about Russia has no interest in negotiating. But Russia was very interested in negotiating Minsk 2015, which the West then betrayed and armed Ukraine and started attacking the East and forbade the Russian language and discriminated against the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. This is why, among the key demands that Russia has offered for negotiations over and over for the past year and a half, one of the key things is to end discrimination against the Russian-speaking and Russian-worshipping population. This is fundamental. This hasn't changed, and the West doesn't necessarily address it. All they say is, well, they're not really interested in negotiating. And similarly, Russia has said all along, the fundamental cause of the war is NATO expansion, and we want, as a result of the war, no Ukraine in NATO. So that hasn't changed either. The West kind of, you know, beats around the bush and says one thing one day and another thing another day about it. So there's a couple other key demands, but the point is, it's completely false and propagandistic to say that Russia has no interest in negotiations. They got to negotiate addressing the root causes of the war. This is what Russia has said over and over. Root cause is discrimination against the Russian Eastern population and NATO expansion.
And this NATO expansion, which has happened since the promise was given by the U.S. Secretary of State, under George Herbert Walker Bush, that in return for Germany being reunited, it was still then divided to East and West Germany, that NATO would not move one foot to the east.
Then it was expanded under Clinton in two big waves. Then we tried a color revolution in Ukraine in 2005. And then we built up our ties there. Victoria Nuland said we put at least $5 billion into it leading up to the coup of 2014, which we co-sponsored. So this is, has deep roots, and want to remind listeners one more time that it dates back to the 90s, because the chief strategist for the empire, Brzezinski, in his famous book, Global Grand Chessboard, identified the strategy of long-term war against Russia, which the key prize was Ukraine. With Ukraine, Russia was very strong. Without Ukraine, Russia was very weak. So again, the strategy is outlined there and pursued ever since, before and since, was war on Russia to weaken Russia, achieve regime change, and gain access to the resources of the world's greatest commodity producer.
And the commodities are not just all the oil and gas and minerals, but also they are very big producers of wheat and other agricultural products, as is the Ukraine. And the Ukraine, a lot of their ships that carry their grain out to countries in Africa and elsewhere that really have needed it. And now, after all these years and years and years of fighting, I can only imagine what's happened with what crops are able to grow and how they're able to get them out of the Ukraine.
Other key commodities besides food and minerals from Russia, and less so from Ukraine, is the phosphates and nitrates and fertilizer components, and this is already resulting in some global shortages of these key farm ingredients, and U.S. Farmers, for that, among other reasons, are going to find their costs going up on fertilizer because of this war.
Yes, that the phosphate, and even Trump in his infinite wisdom has put a tariff on phosphates coming from Canada. Well, it increases their how much it costs farmers, and it's surprising how much the economy is being wrecked in all because of these tariffs. When I was a callow youth in high school, a conservative teacher talked to me about the Smoot-Hawley tariffs from the 30s, and talking it up, and I was just taking it in. And this is the whole Trump agenda, and is having the same disastrous results which it has had historically in how things work in this world. The one good thing about these recent talks, the five-hour talks with Trump, with Witkoff, and Jared Kushner, when they came away from the session, their impression was that if Putin does want to make a deal. So there is some hope for it there, but there's a lot of people wanting to keep it going, and a lot of people in Europe, for some reason.
The leaders.
The leaders only, amazingly, who are now willing to buy all the weapons from the U.S. and then give them to the Ukraine, and then send up all these warning signals. Oh, Russia's after us. Russia's going to come after us next. You better be worried. Spend all our money on all these armaments.
Yeah, and on behalf of the military-industrial, it's not going to help the security or the economy or anything. And anyway, this Russian invasion of Europe is complete fiction to defend the interest I just mentioned. And Putin himself said it ridiculous. I think it's ridiculous. Putin said 100 times there's no basis for this. Ukraine is a special case. This is why the war has been prosecuted the way it has. Putin just told us any war in Europe is going to be very, very different and shorter.
Until you know the history of what goes on, you can't understand it. And so you are easily misled as to what goes on because they are relentless. Hundreds of times saying Russia was not provoked. Russia did it unprovoked. And Davis, you knew it before, but then you've read that book, large parts of that book called Provoked.
Yeah, I've got a thin book and a medium-sized book and a very thick book all about how it was provoked and planned and provoked since the 90s, at least, as I've been seeing. I want to mention one more thing in the same vein about how this stuff goes back even further, because there was a student of John Mearsheimer's named Lindsay O'Rourke, who is now a professor at Boston College, and she's written a book, Covert Regime Change, 1947 to 1989. In other words, just 42 years leading up to the supposed end of the Cold War. And she ended it there because she could use declassified material so there wouldn't be any disputing about source material. And during those years, again, ending 25, 35 years ago, there had been 70 regime change operations by the U.S. in other countries. 64 of them were covert, and covert simply means denied on the official level by the U.S., even though it's completely blessed officially. Only 6 out of 70 were actually acknowledged by the officials in the U.S.
The reason we go over all this here, I find so necessary and needed, is that when I woke up during the Vietnam War, I was going to go into some sort of State Department or foreign policy governmental work. And then as I finally found out what the history was of the U.S. in Vietnam, I had to go over it. I had to learn it myself and then go over it. And then I did literature tables in the basement of Kauffman Union when I was on campus with Students Against Selective Service and when we had the Draft Information Center and anti-war activities. Is to go over and over again what the history of Vietnam was, how did this come about. It takes a while when you're overcoming everything that people saying in the media, and there's a drumbeat, because they have the so much of the echo chamber of the liberal media, both and the corporate media and the public media. They're all pretty much the same. It's just an occasional. I've only heard one reference to this, what I was talking about earlier, this 2022 March-April talks in Istanbul, which would have ended the war. Now, it was a brief thing. I just remembered the one place I heard a little sketchy place was on the PBS Evening News. But nobody else ever talks about it. Nobody else ever gives the history.
It's just like leading right up to the 2014 coup. There were numerous articles in Western press, Guardian, U.S. press, and so on about the Nazis in Ukraine, a strong neo-Nazi movement. After the coup we sponsored, those stories disappeared from the mainstream media.
Well, this has been another edition of Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson and Dave Gudnick. And it's getting time to let Global Beat to take over and with Doug Kane.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
For centuries, Dakota, Ojibwe, and other indigenous growers in Minnesota preserved seeds after each growing season. Each kernel carried memories of place, family, and survival. Seed saving wasn't just about farming. It was about responsibility. A way to ensure that future generations would never go hungry, even after floods, droughts, or displacement. In the 19th and 20th centuries, as industrial agriculture spread and hybrid crops took over, these traditional practices were pushed aside, but they never disappeared. Indigenous elders and seed keepers quietly held